over the years. And we have been burdened for the young people that are in our Christian schools and homeschools, especially, that they would continue their Christian education on the university level. We're losing so many of the ones, especially that are interested in science, going off to secular schools. We were just with one of my former students, biochemistry major at Columbia, on our way down here, and we had lunch with them, and she was talking about how she got almost a free ride to Baylor University near her home in Texas, and how she was trying to decide between going to Bob Jones University and going to Baylor. And when she came to Bob Jones, and she thought, I want to hear science from a biblical perspective, from a creation worldview. I don't want to have to spend my 4 years trying to fight against everything that I'm being taught. And she said, oh, I'm so glad I made that decision. And so unfortunately, a lot of times the young people decide to go off to secular schools. And we find that that's because somehow they think that it's going to be better, they'll have better equipment or whatever. And so we want to make sure the young people know that they have this option, that they can go to get a quality science education in a Christian environment. Well, the pastors asked me to talk today about the age of the earth. And there's so much, there's just, you know, you could say about this. I just chose some favorite things. And I'm going to stop after a little while and give you an opportunity to ask questions, because it's that's important to me to know what you want to know and how I can be a help to you and give you some ammunition and things that would be helpful. So if you could turn in your Bibles to Genesis 5:3 with me, Genesis 5:3. Oh, next, no, not yet. Oops, what's happened here? We got, there we go. I must push the button. Thank you. All right, Genesis 5:3. So how old do you think the earth is? How old does it look? What do you think that what you believe about the earth, age of the earth, makes a difference? So my goal today is explain some of the scientific evidences for a young earth in a way I hope will be understandable. But before I get to the science, let me tell you why I believe that the earth is thousands rather than billions of years old. It's because of passages like this. In verse 3, and Adam lived 130 years and begat a son in his own likeness after his image and called his name Seth. And the days of Adam after he had begotten Seth were 800 years and he begat sons and daughters. And all the days that Adam lived were 930 years and he died. You ever wondered why there's all these genealogies in scripture? I don't know if you're like me. I used to get to those and I thought, oh, you know, I got this section for my Bible reading today, and it's like going through this desert trying to get to an oasis on the other side, you know, all these names and dates and so forth. So what's the purpose of all that? But the genealogies not only provide information about how long people lived and dating of biblical events, and that can be useful in itself, but they really provide refutation of evolution and support of creation. You know, in the current controversy over creation and evolution, it's a rare thing to find something that both evolutionists and creationists agree on. And one of those things that they agree on is there has to be time. It's impossible to have random process. Well, it's impossible altogether, but impossible to do it in a short period of time, according to the evolutionist. A man named Professor George Wald, Harvard professor, he stated in his book, The Origin of Life, time, in fact, is the hero of the plot. Given so much time, the impossible becomes possible, the possible probable, and the probable virtually certain. One has only to wait. Time itself performs miracles. And so they're looking for miracles as well. And one of the miracles that is supposed to have occurred by time is us, the fact that we're here. If you went to, you know, a secular scientist who believes in evolution and you'd say, well, you know, how do you know that evolution is true? They'd say, well, we're here, aren't we? I mean, what other proof do you need that we're here? And he said, well, how about creation? And they would say, well, that's not science. And they're right about that. Creation is not science, okay? But even though creation is not science, we can use the scientific tools to undermine the billions of years that they need to work the so-called miracle of evolution. And I would add the fact that evolution is not science either, okay? And the reason it's not science is because it's not falsifiable. I used to teach the philosophy of science at one point at Bob Jones, and we talked about this idea about falsifiability. Let me try to get across that idea. And let's say that you had a group of scientists who found evidence that dinosaurs lived only 1,000 years and not tens of millions of years ago that the theory of evolution predicts. Would that prove evolution to be wrong? I was talking to Tom earlier, and he was talking about how, you know, we've been finding the soft tissue. You can see some of the soft tissue from the dinosaur bones. And this was unheard of. The first time we found this was in 2005. There was a dinosaur, Tyrannosaurus rex, out in Montana, and they were trying to save it from being people stealing it because these things are rather expensive. So they got a helicopter, they flew it there, and they tried to get all the dinosaur bones into the helicopter real fast. And the big femur couldn't fit in the door. They couldn't get it in the door. And so they did what any scientist would do. They broke it in half to get it in the door. And when they broke it in half, the guy who did it, he had worked in the Bosnian killing fields with uncovering graves and so forth. And he said it had the smell of death. So this idea that this dinosaur is supposed to be 65 million years old, that it would smell like death, that really set him back. So he sent samples to Mary Schweitzer, who's a professor at NC State up here, and she analyzed these things. And so listen to the summary of 2005 Science News. I want to get this point across about the falsifiability of science. In March, and I'm quoting, paleontologists discovered the existence of soft tissues in a 68 million year old Tyrannosaurus rex fossil. An unprecedented find in prehistoric creature, scientists had assumed no tissue could survive more than 100,000 years. The soft tissue included cells and blood vessels. The scientist who made the discovery, Dr. Mary Schweitzer, is quoted as saying, and I quote, "It was exactly like looking at a slice of modern bone. But of course I couldn't believe it. I said to the lab technician, the bones after all are 65 million years old. How could blood cells survive that long?" So notice that her first reaction was not to question the old Earth paradigm. Her first question, what she questioned was the evidence itself. Okay? And that's very telling. Another man said, the state of preservation noted in this study is improbable, but obviously not impossible. So there you have it. The theory of evolution is not a scientific theory because all contrary scientific evidence is improbable, but obviously not impossible, okay? Well, even if we can't, those of us who believe in biblical creation, if we can't prove that the theory of evolution is false, we at least can deny them the time they need to make it happen. I think this is a funny quote. My wife doesn't think it's funny, but I think it is. Time is a great healer, but a lousy beautician. She doesn't think it's that funny. I look in the mirror and I see that's true every day. And that's the direction of time. The direction of time is downward. Okay. Well, let me give you a few of my favorite evidences of a young Earth, and I'll open it up for questions then. So the recent date of civilization. So civilization goes back to about 5,000 years. The early written history of Egypt begins with the palette of Namur, which is 3,200 BC. And what you see is archaeology shows that these civilizations, like in Egypt rose up quickly, rapidly, and were very sophisticated. You have elaborate calendars and seagoing ships and impressive buildings like the pyramids. You'd have a hard time building a pyramid today, even with modern machinery, doing something like that. And that's what we'd expect right after the flood. It's almost like, you know, it's right there. Secondly, population statistics. At a population growth rate of 2% a year, it would take only about 1,100 years to reach a population of 6 billion on the Earth. If mankind was even a million years old, the growth rate would only be 0.002%. And that's not viable. We know from small populations of animals that are going extinct, we know that if you have these small populations over a long period of time, the mutation rate is so great that essentially they go to extinction. We've been trying to bring some animals back from extinction, get all this inbreeding and mutations and so forth. It's impossible with a small population. But using conservative figures of about 0.5% per year, the Earth population that we have now could have had 8 people about 5,000 years ago. I'm thinking of a particular 8 people, okay, that were on this boat, okay? Another issue to consider is, why are human bones so scarce? As you can see on the slide, even with low growth rate because of limited food, we would be knee-deep in bones by now. Okay, we'd have to shovel through them to get to church this morning. And the interesting thing is that all the sort of human evolution things that they have, where they, you know, different creatures, Australopithecus, this or that, or whatever, if you took all those bones together, you could fit them in a single coffin. I mean, that's how much we have. You know, we don't have the huge numbers that you'd expect for mankind to be around for such a long period of time. Erosion rates. The average yearly amount of mud carried into the sea is about 25 billion tons per year by erosion. The mass of the continents above sea level is estimated to be about 383 million billion tons. Now, some of that mud is recycled back by those subducting plates and comes up as volcanoes and that kind of thing. But we know pretty much what the rate is. And so we would expect that everything would be eroded down to sea level in about 12 million years at that rate. 12 million years is a lot less than 4.5 billion years. And the mud's not building up fast enough. For example, the Mississippi River Delta, there is 300 million cubic yards of mud deposited in the Gulf of Mexico by the Mississippi River each year. So you take the amount of mud that's deposited and the total weight of the Mississippi Delta, and guess what? You get an age of about 4,000 years, okay? And so it's clear. And we could look at a lot of things. We could look at accumulation of chemical compounds in the ocean, nitrates, uranium compounds that don't break down or recycle, and all those concentrations are much, much lower. We have thousands of years of concentrations, not millions or billions. If people just understand how long a million years is or a billion years is, they just say these numbers, but they forget that there's erosion occurring all during this time. I've had this neat opportunity. A man out in Utah has asked me to give a little tour of Bryce Canyon. You ever been to Bryce Canyon? You ever been to Bryce Canyon? Okay. And you remember, it drops off. There's a bench there, and it drops off to the hoodoos that you see there, and they keep moving that bench back because they don't want the, you know, because it's continuing to erode. Well, if you had a million years of that, you know, the Bryce Canyon would be up in Montana somewhere, you know, it'd be on the Canadian border. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. You know, they just don't think about how long these things are. I've taken mission teams to Australia for 23 years with my wife, and there's a place called the Great Ocean Road. They have something called the 12 Apostles there, these formations that are caused by erosion of the Southern Ocean. And there's not 12 apostles anymore. There's like 8 left. The other apostles fell down and so forth. New apostles are being formed. And you look at the erosion rate, well, that formation, they would be up in, you know, it would have already gone all the way across to Australia. They're, you know, it eroded its way up to the to the north. Well, slides. Earth's magnetic field, since 1829, we've been measuring the precise intensity of the Earth's magnetic field. That's the force that turns the compass needle north. We can put a little, you know, balance on there and measure it, how strong that force is. And what we found is that magnetic field has been decaying for about 7% per year. That means you lose about half of it every 1,400 years. And there's some indication, we won't go into today, the field lost strength a lot more during the flood. In any case, we know how big the planet is. We know how big a magnetic field it could possibly contain based on that size. And the upper limit then is like 20,000 years. And I'm really interested in the magnetic field because we're seeing it continue to decay. And as it decays, we get more cosmic radiation coming in and impinging upon us. And there's people that are concerned about this, about the fact that we're losing our protective shield, you know, from the radiation from outer space. And then there are the comets. Comets are icy asteroids that orbit around the sun. And every time they pass close to a planet or to the sun, they lose material. The short period comets lose about 1% per year on average. A lot of the meteor showers you see, like the Perseid meteor shower in October, that's remnants of when Halley's Comet came close to us and lost some material. And we see that every year as we go through that rubble. So they're disintegrating. Well, you can't keep them going for, you know, more than 10,000 years. They just decay too quickly. So in 1950, they had this great idea. They said, well, there must be this reservoir of comets way out in the solar system, way out there, and he called it the Oort cloud. And so every once in a while, one of those things gets jostled and it flies into the inner solar system. And that we get more new comets forming all the time. Well, the problem with that is that since 1950, our telescopes have gotten a lot better. And so we should be able to see the Oort cloud with all these comets out there. And we can't see them. Okay, they're not there. There's no evidence of them being there. And so it was a nice idea, but there's no evidence, scientific evidence for it. So the fact that there's still comets means that the solar system must be young. And then there is Jupiter. I don't know if you're in your devotions this morning, you thank the Lord for Jupiter. You should thank the Lord for Jupiter. It keeps a lot of things from crashing into the Earth. It's like a big solar system vacuum cleaner. It sucks up those things and keeps them from coming into the inner solar system and hitting us. So we're thankful for Jupiter. But, you know, we've been taught that the energy coming from a planet like this would be, you know, it would take an energy from the sun and it would put out the same amount of energy to us. But that's not what happens. It doesn't happen for Jupiter. It doesn't happen for Uranus or Saturn or Neptune. All of them put out more energy than they take in. In fact, Jupiter gives off 26 trillion kilowatts per day, which is twice as much power as it takes in from the sun. So where does that energy come from? Well, the sun produces energy because of fusion, but there's no fusion going on in Jupiter. And so the best explanation is that God created Jupiter with a massive amount of internal energy, and it's still quite young. It's still giving off that energy that was there at the original creation. Otherwise, in 4.5 billion years, it would have certainly cooled off by now. Pluto. Pluto is too young. Pluto is a traitor to the evolutionary cause. When they predicted, the New Horizon scientists, that they predicted what they would see at Pluto, because you can't see it really clearly with telescopes, they predicted it would have the oldest cratered surface in the solar system. But as you can see, it doesn't. Pluto actually has the youngest surface in the solar system. How's that possible? Why are there no craters in some of those places? Where's the energy coming from that keeps Pluto young and dynamic? Well, some people said, well, it must be tidal forces. It has a sister planet, Charon. Okay, but they're tidally locked to each other. They rotate around, they keep the same face to each other. There's no tidal forces at all. Add insult to injury, there are ice mountains on Pluto, that is water ice mountains, that are higher than Mount Everest. Where did those mountains come from? There's no tidal forces. Again, the best evidence is that Pluto is young. It's almost like a joke on these guys. They go out there and find the youngest planetary surface in the solar system is the one that's furthest away from the sun. So we started by looking at these biblical genealogies that some people think are boring. We have some evidence now of young Earth, and all this points to the trustworthiness of Scripture. The Bible is not a book of science, but everything it says is scientifically accurate. So let me stop here. I have more that I could say, but let's stop here and let's see what questions you have before we continue on. Yes, sir. Well, we found it downstream, but it's a lot further downstream than they expect it to be because it was carved out a lot faster. You can look at Grand Canyon, you can see there's places where the walls have slumped. And so that shows you that it was carved out quickly. Well, it was still soft, it was still unconsolidated, okay, after the flood. And interesting, we're talking about erosion too. How many of you have been to the Grand Canyon? Okay, we've got a few here. And what does it look like at the top of the Grand Canyon? It's flat, like that. It's amazing. You drive up to it, it's just completely flat. And then there's this big hole in the ground, okay? Well, you know, they say that that top rock is a half a million years old. Okay, so hasn't it ever rained there? Does it ever snow? I mean, is there no erosion taking place for a half a million years? I mean, you would expect to see that whole thing be eroded, you know, but you have this knife edge type of strata there. So it doesn't look half a million years old. It looks new. It looks young. And so the Grand Canyon is, of course, good evidence of a young Earth. Anything else? Any other questions? I guess we can go home. Oh, I guess we can't go home. Yes.
Mm-hmm. It takes over 8 minutes for the light to come from the sun to the earth. Mm-hmm. But I had a hard time to explain light from stars mm-hmm. to people who are non-believers. When I use a young creation theory, mm-hmm. because they'll say, well, how far is a light year? And then, you know, it's trillions of miles. But still, it just takes a long time for that light to get there. When you talk about great distances, like a galaxy, you know, like they're pretty long. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which would mean how long that might take to come from there. Yeah, how would you go about to describe that to somebody?
Well, talking about the light from the stars, have you ever heard of Philip Henry Goss? Does that name mean anything to you? So we should know his name. He was a contemporary of Darwin. And they actually knew each other. Goss actually had samples he sent to Darwin and biological samples. And Goss wrote some books, and he was the one, by the way, who invented the aquarium, you know, the home aquarium, you know, that people would put fish in and so forth. And so he was a lot more famous than Darwin back in his own day. But everybody's forgotten about Philip Henry Goss because he was a Christian. In fact, he was a lay preacher, he was the first person I know that thought about this problem, about the apparent age of the Earth. And so, of course, this is long before the modern creationist movement. He was by himself. He didn't have a lot to go on. And so he came up with the first idea about that, is that God created everything with apparent age. that God not only created the stars, but he created the light from the stars, that type of thing. So he was the first one to originate that. And that certainly is true, you know, that God could have done that. But the problem with that for us is, you know, we have astronomers that are at Bob Jones, and they study binary stars, and they're actually, you know, looking at the mathematics of the stars, and you can actually calculate the change in the rotation rate of those stars around each other based on the theory of relativity. And they actually very exactly fit the general theory of relativity. And so they actually believe that they're looking at something real. It's kind of hard to think of that as just sort of like a moving picture show that God has put up in the heavens to, you know, that's not actual, something actually happening. And so that's always been a problem for me to think about that. And so one of the theories that I have come to find appreciation for is the one that Russ Humphreys came up with. And that's the idea, his book's called Starlight and Time. And the idea that during creation week, the universe expands at relativistic speeds on the surface of a white hole. And if you do that, what you find out is that you're changing time and space. So time in deep space is not the same as time here. Okay, and so we have six literal solar days on the Earth, but in space you have, you know, millions and billions of years going on. And so it has to be something like that. It has to be that, you know, the time is different in space than it is here. Some people have talked about the speed of light changing, but I have a problem with that as well, because the speed of light is embedded into the fabric of the universe. James Clerk Maxwell actually calculated the speed of light. He was a Christian as well. And he calculated the speed of light before it could be measured. And he had it right, too. And so I have a problem with that. So either the speed of light has to be different, something different as far as distance is concerned, or time has to be different. So I think the best solution that we have right now is the idea that somehow time is different in deep space than it is here. Okay. So there's a lot of things about this we don't understand. Creationists themselves are still, you know, talking about these different theories. There's a theory that Jason Lyle has. His idea is that the speed of light is one direction going out and another speed coming back. And one speed going out, another speed coming back. And that solves some of the problems. Okay. One of the things we have to be able to explain with these theories is the cosmic background radiation that we see. And this theory about relativity and time being different in space it seems to explain that better than anything else. Did you have a, yeah?
If we have trillions of stars.
Yes.
In the sky, we have all these people with these telescopes that are looking there.
Yes.
If they were evolving through time.
Yeah. Well, you know, of course, as you look back, you know, further into space, you're looking back into time. I mean, we all kind of agree on that, no matter what our time frame would be. And so the idea is that the galaxy should be lesser developed earlier on. But that's not what we find. We don't find that the galaxies really far out look somehow primitive or less developed than galaxies that are closer. Okay, so that would be evidence, again, that was all created at the same time rather than, you know, this evolution of space taking place. You have these spiral galaxies, like our galaxy is a spiral galaxy. I wish I had a picture of it where they had the arms and so forth. And as it wraps around in time, you lose the spiral shape and you just get this sort of circular. And so it should be all the galaxies that are really, really old, they should have all stopped being spirals. They should have gone, you know, sort of fuzzed out into this platter type of shape. And we don't see that either. Okay, so there's something really funny going on with that, but all of it indicates that the universe is young, not old. So I wouldn't give up your belief in the Bible based on the speed of light, okay? There's a lot of unanswered questions there. Even if creationists don't agree with each other about how this could happen, we have at least five different theories that I could name right offhand that would explain how the light got here from the stars. Certainly not a good reason to throw your Bible away. Okay. Any other questions? Yes. Yeah. Sure. If I was looking at you know, the best evidences for evolution, the first would be complexity. In other words, that you know, we have, you know, what was called irreducible complexity, that even so-called, you know, simple systems in the body are more complex than anything that we can manufacture. So every individual cell of the body is more complex than the most complex manufacturing facility that we have. And the idea that this came about, you know, through random processes is just, you know, beggar's belief. Okay, so I would do complexity. I would do thermodynamics. Of course, I've taught physical chemistry for many, many years. And but thermodynamics, don't let it scare you. That's just heat in motion. But the idea, the first law of thermodynamics is that energy can neither be created or destroyed. It just changes form, you know, from one type of energy to another. And I mean, just on the face of it, you would say, all right, therefore the universe, the energy in the universe had to come about by a supernatural process, or a matter itself must be eternal. Okay. Well, it can't be eternal because the second law of thermodynamics, which tells us that there's this downward trend. We talked about time being a lousy beautician. Well, that's certainly true, that, you know, we know that the direction of time's arrow is downward. Okay, the energy is going from being more available to being less available. Let's say I had a match here in my hand. I strike the match burns. Where did that heat go? Well, it goes into the room, and all of you are a little bit warmer than you would have been otherwise. Now let's collect all that energy that escaped into the room, and let's put it back on the head of the match. That's a bit harder, isn't it? Okay. We're all aware of this direction that nature has. Some kids ask me, they say, is time travel possible? Oh, sure, I said, time travel's possible. Just come up here, and I'll hit you on the head with a mallet, and when you come to, you'll be in the future. You know, and nobody wants to time travel that way. Okay. The bigger problem is going backwards in time. And so the time's arrow is always going in one direction. You say, why is it that way? I don't know. God created it that way, but it corresponds to the laws of thermodynamics. And so we can't go backwards, but we can go forwards. And so if matter and energy was eternal, then all of it would have run out by now. Everything, the whole universe would go into a single temperature, and there would be no temperature differences. Everything would be dead and lifeless, and that energy would be diffused throughout the universe. The fact that we have a universe that is young and dynamic, and there's still energy sources that are hotter than other places, and we know then that the universe must be young. So thermodynamics would be the second thing that I would look at. So complexity and thermodynamics, and then probably if I had the third one, I'd talk about the age. You know, I mean, I literally could talk about 100 different things today that show that the solar system and the universe are young. Okay. And now what people will tell you is, you know, so, well, how about radiometric dating? And I don't have time for all this, but let me just go through it real fast, and people want to know how do they come up with these old dates for rocks? And what they do is, you know, we're talking about in the 19th century. This is before radioactivity was discovered. They decide how old things had to be for complexity to come about by random processes. And it takes a really, really long time. So if I take my watch here and I take it all apart and I put it into the washing machine, how long do I have to run the washing machine until it turns back into a functioning watch again? Okay. Well, a long time. Okay. Gonna take a long time. Okay. And so they need time. And so they kind of dated everything based on the theory of evolution. And so they had some what they call index fossils, and they decided these index fossils were certain ages based on evolution. And then they dated the rocks by the fossils. Okay. And then you say, well, how do they know how old the fossils were? Well, they date the fossils then by the rocks. And you just get this circular reasoning. The only way out of this is by radiometric dating techniques. So something like this, where you have a uranium atom at the beginning, it decays to thorium and radium and radon and bismuth, the lead. So you have a parent atom, uranium, and you have a daughter atom, lead. And so you find out how much lead is present, how much uranium is present, and based on that ratio, you can figure out how old everything is. Well, the problem with that, number one, is you don't know how much parent you started with. Okay, that's a problem. And the second thing is you don't know how much lead you started with. I mean, lead's a useful element. There's no particular reason to think that God didn't create some lead in the crust of the earth as well as uranium. So that kind of is a problem with that. And then you don't know what the decay rate is. You say, well, we've measured it. Well, how long have we measured decay rates of uranium or any of these other radioactive elements? Well, what, when Madame Curie, was she alive? Early 20th century, okay? So we've been measuring these for, 100 years. But does that mean that that's the decay rate for thousands of years or millions of years or whatever that they... And so we don't really know those things. There's good evidence, I might add, that there's been rapid radioactive decay in the past. We have good evidence that that is true. So, can we use the rate of radioactive decay to figure out how old rocks are? One of the things about uranium is when it decays, it gives off helium. It gives off an alpha particle, which is a helium nucleus, picks up electrons on its way out. And so you have this helium that's trapped in the rock. Actually, you've seen a piece of granite. Okay, you see a little black flecks of the granite. That's called biotite mica. And inside the biotite mica, you can only see it under a microscope, are zircons. And zircons have little atoms of uranium trapped in them. And so when the uranium decay, this is an actual radio halo under a microscope. You have a little seed of uranium in the center, and it's decaying. You see those rings coming out? Those rings of destruction are because of shooting out these alpha particles. Okay? And it's causing this kind of sphere of destruction. So we can actually count these. We can see how much uranium was there, how much decay is taking place. But also, we find that there's helium trapped in the rock. And we can measure that. We can take a zircon, and we can measure the helium escape rate at various temperatures. And so we know if we heat the helium up really hot, the helium can all leave the rock. And so we know if we find a rock with no helium in it that it's probably because it's been very hot for a long time. And so what we find is rocks that are supposed to be 1.5 billion years old from deep in the earth, and they still have helium trapped in them. So why did the helium leave? We know how fast helium diffuses through the rock, how come there's still helium there? And so we have this unusual situation where the radio halos, the number of them and so forth, tell us there's been a lot of radioactive decay taking place in a short period of time. The helium tells us that it is a short period of time, that those rocks are still young, because the helium is still trapped in the rock. Which age do we believe? We believe the younger one, of course, because that puts the minimum age or the maximum age on those rocks for us. Okay, so those are some kind of the things you can, and people think, you know, they think that radioactive measuring device, dating processes have given us all the information that we need in order to, solve these issues. But it's because, you know, they haven't thought about it very carefully, about the logic that goes into it and the things we don't know about these radioactive decay processes. We've got just a couple minutes. Any follow-up on those? Yes?
I just want to ask if I can take a picture of you.
You want to take a picture of me? She's in promo mode. We're going to try to take this on the road here around the country. I'm calling myself the Bob Jones University Science Ambassador. And so this is something we want to do around the country. And this is the first time we've done it under that label. So I appreciate any feedback you can give me. Yes? Yes. Well, I think that's what she's working on. It's getting some materials that we can post. We don't have a website yet, so this is all very new. I'm going to start traveling in August, and we're going to start out west, and some churches have invited us to go there. And so this is, yes.
Mm-hmm. And how much energy does, and what's the fraction of energy that we as humans can burn that we live in,
yep.
Candle, whatever.
Yep. Yeah, so the global warming, I actually have a message on global warming, but your pastor didn't choose that one. So we'll have to get that when we come back around the next time around. The amazing thing about global warming is the fact not that things are warming, because we would expect that. After the flood, we'd expect things would get, you have the flood and then you have the ice age, you expect things to be warming up since the ice age. What's amazing is how constant the temperature is, how balanced the temperature is. You know, we're the only place in the solar system that has these, you know, stable temperatures that allow life. You get these huge changes in temperature everywhere else. And that's the amazing evidence of God's providence, that he has caused the temperature to be so, I mean, we're all these discussions about global warming. I've taught about global warming. I teach a course called Science Impact on Society, and I've taught that for over 20 years. And the amazing thing is that we're only talking about 1 degree Celsius. We're talking about 1 degree Celsius over a 100-year period. And all the discussions you hear is about 1 degree Celsius over 100 years. And so the fact that we have that kind of stability shows us, he gives us evidence of God's wisdom and how he created our world for our good. Okay, well, look forward to speaking this morning. We're going to talk about science in the book of Job, 7 lessons from science in the book of Job. I hope you'll find that to be a blessing to you. Let's